Good evening. Welcome to Monday's Sport at 7. Coming up over the next half an hour, on so many occasions in the past, we've delighted in clean sweeps of success for Irish provinces in Europe's elite rugby club competitions. This weekend, we have to take our medicine as they return four defeats from four. We'll chat to Eamon Dunphy about the weekend's English Premier League action and more. And you know the identity of the first man to jump a fence aboard a show-jumping horse at Croke Park. You will by the close of business at 7:30. Our email address tonight, sport@7@rte.ie. At RTE Sport at 7, we'll find us on Twitter. If you'd like to text us from Northern Ireland, send the word studio, followed by your message to 80889. From the Republic, our number 51551.
Sport at 7 with Damien O'Mara on RTE Radio 1, in association with AIB. Supporting clubs, supporting communities.
And it is rugby to start the programme this evening, and not something we've spoken about too often in recent years. Not one win from Ireland's provinces in Europe this weekend. Eric Elwood and Connacht beaten by Biarritz.
The lads were up for the game, we spoke about it, we were ready for the game. We knew it was going to be a big challenge, obviously the conditions didn't suit us. But yeah, we were ready, prepped well, we were in a good space. But unfortunately, you know, you make a couple of mistakes at this level, we got punished.
Joe Schmidt's Leinster by Claremont.
It was pretty tough going. You know, I certainly knew with the quality that Claremont have, and after having really pushed them close over there, that they would come back even stronger. And unfortunately, they did.
Ulster under Mark Anscombe by Northampton.
You know, the way we'd been going and why we played last week, I suppose you'd expect that we would have done the job at home. You know, we've got a passionate crowd and they normally bring the guys home, and we let them down today with our performance.
And the Rob Penny coach Munster by Saracens.
Right up until the last minute, really, we were still within a chance of capturing a victory, but disappointing, obviously, that we weren't able to do so, but it certainly wasn't through lack of effort.
So much for us to reflect upon. We'll do so in the company of Brendan Fanning, rugby correspondent with the Sunday Independent. Hiya, Brendan. You're there?
Yeah, James.
How are you? Four defeats from four. I think we have to go all the way back to January 2007 since that's happened in European competition. But if we're honest, can any of the provinces have much of a complaint?
I think Ulster, had they just been a bit more efficient and a bit more accurate with the goal kicking, would have got away with a win. But as it happens, they're the ones to suffer least. I mean, it would be a serious setback and a serious upset in form if they don't go on and get out of there. In fact, I'd say Ulster still have a reasonably decent chance of getting a home draw in the quarters. As for Leinster, they were well beaten with a good 25-30 minutes to go. It was pursuit of a bonus point at that stage, as in a losing bonus point, obviously. And Munster, I don't know if you watched it yourself, Damien, it was just a fabulous cup tie. It really, really was a top-quality game of rugby. And there was one point in the second half where they went through over 20 phases and they were en route to, while they were trying to open Saracens up with a view to scoring a try, it wasn't a question of eking out enough space for Ronan O'Gara to drop a goal. And at the end of that, he did attempt a drop goal, which went wide. And with that, you felt that their only chance of getting home here is by penalties or drop goals, and it just wasn't going to happen. But it was good to watch.
Yeah, and the difficulty, if we go all the way back to Friday, Connacht, we saw at the sports ground the previous weekend that they set about a game plan that didn't involve engaging with Biarritz up front, but the conditions on Friday just didn't lend that to a repeat.
Well, the game shouldn't have gone ahead. I thought it was actually dangerous, and I've seen games called off in much better circumstances than that. You know, you have to credit both teams for coming through the far side. How they played rugby in those circumstances was just beyond me. It really shouldn't have happened. Mm.
Do you just put this down to a blip, or is there something more to it in your mind?
Well, it was interesting, after the Leinster game, Joe Schmidt was almost sounding valedictory. He mentioned, pretty early on in the piece, he mentioned what that group had achieved and how good those achievements were. And immediately you had that vibe that, you know, it's over, and he's recognised it's over. Now he backtracked a little bit thereafter. It isn't over, but clearly their chances of getting out of this are more possible than probable. Mm. Leinster have struggled in a couple of areas, nowhere more so than getting a partner for Leo Cullen, and Leo is pretty much on the downward slope himself now. Leo's 33. But if you look at the three titles that Leinster won, they had Malcolm O'Kelly as his partner in 09, they had Nathan Hines in 11, they had Brad Thorne last year. They hoped Quinn Roof in South Africa would fill that gap, and he got injured twice, the most recent of which is a dislocated shoulder, which has taken him out for most of the season. So they really struggled there, and Damien Brown was gone at half-time on Saturday, and that has been a big issue for them. And they have achieved fantastically well. But it would not be a major surprise if they didn't get through. I'd say lots of us reckoned, having looked at that pool at the start, that Leinster might not come out of it. You can't possibly have the same hunger for it three times in a row. And when you factor in the injuries that they've suffered, obviously Kearney and O'Driscoll are major losses, plus that non-replacement of either Hines or Thorne, then it was going to be a seriously uphill struggle.
Yeah, but realistically, we're looking at a situation now where Leinster or Munster's pools are unlikely to provide best second place spots, but equally Leinster, it's unlikely with the rate of try scoring that has been seen at this stage this season that they would have the ability or do enough to get two bonus points in the next two games.
I'm not sure I'd agree with you, Damien, on the fact that either of those pools are unlikely to produce a best place runner-up, particularly Munster's pool. Munster can readily finish on 20 points, and 20 points may be enough to get them out. The only reason Racing are in the mix here is because they've just gone back-to-back with Edinburgh. That's why Racing are looking as good as they are. Leinster's pool clearly is a lot more difficult, and they don't have as good a chance of getting out. You know, they need favours elsewhere. Specifically, they need Montpellier to collapse, and they need Saints to collapse. I don't think Montpellier are going to collapse. They're away to Sale in the next game, and they're home to Toulon in the last round. I think they have a decent chance of beating Toulon. Saints, meanwhile, are home to Castres and away to Glasgow. So without a collapse from either of those two, certainly it's going to be a struggle. But I wouldn't rule Munster out by any chance. I think they will still have a reasonably decent chance of getting in, probably as the worst qualifier. Meanwhile, Leinster will have to end up probably going into the unfamiliar territory of the Amlin.
And obviously disappointment as well for Ulster over the weekend, and you add the injury to Tommy Bowe onto that as well. But I don't know, maybe from a psychological point of view, this run of, you know, this run without loss had to end at some point. I wonder, are they as well off getting that off their backs?
If I was in Ulster, I'd rather just keep winning, to be honest. I don't think defeat is going to make them play any better. And as it happens, they've got Leinster on Friday night, a game neither of them really want at all. Both of them are battered after what happened at the weekend, and have to fetch up on Friday night, and the rabble is the last thing they want. But I wouldn't be overly concerned about Ulster. They really could have, they could readily have won that game, and I'd say, you know, clearly they're the favourite of our provinces to do well, and I think they will do well.
Do you think, before I let you go, could we possibly have seen the winner at the Aviva Stadium in Claremont, and how they're shaping up and the way with which they're approaching the competition this year?
Well, Vern Cotter, their coach, Damien, was asked afterwards, you know, did he think that they could... Well, two interesting questions. One was, did he think they could win it? And mostly when you ask a coach something like that, his immediate response is, well, let's get out of the pool first. And he said yes. He did think they could win it. And that was their aim, to go as far as they possibly could. Next, he was asked, did he think you could fight the war on two fronts, i.e. top 14 and Heineken Cup? And he said, no, you couldn't. Okay. So they have clearly targeted this competition. And if they repeat the sort of form that they produced against Leinster, they will be almost unstoppable.
And yeah, they'll be back in Dublin later on, well, early next year. Brendan, many thanks for joining us. Brendan Fanning of the Sunday Independent. There are two texts into 51551. Leinster's problem is Joe Schmidt. He's given up and wants home. Leinster needs three powerful forwards, is obvious to supporters. That's from John to 51551. Who would ever want to be a coach in situations like this? One other text in as well. So the French and English are finally taking the Heineken Cup seriously. 51551 is our text number. We might try and cheer you up. We've 10 copies of the history of Leinster rugby on DVD to give away tonight. We want you to tell us, who did Michael Checker replace as Leinster coach? 51551. It's soccer next, where the Everton midfielder Marouane Fellaini has been banned for 3 matches after accepting a charge of violent conduct for his headbutt on Stoke's Ryan Shawcross over the weekend. The English FA brought the charge retrospectively. Eamon Dunphy is with us. Eamon, good evening to you.
Good evening, Damon.
If we start with Merseyside, Everton, interesting, and I suppose Moyes deserves credit for actually coming out admitting he saw the incident and chastising his player quite publicly.
Yes, he did, and he's done that consistently before as well. He's an exception, David Moyes. He's always very straightforward, and he doesn't tolerate it, and there's often internal club discipline imposed as well. So it's very welcome. He's a great example.
Is 3 matches light?
Well, in my view, it is. I think, you know, punishments for misbehaviour should be severe if you want to change the culture. And that has to be the objective of any disciplinary system. I mean, this isn't a sort of, you know, this isn't just an indiscretion. This isn't a minor matter. You know, it's very serious, violent conduct. And if you want to stop it and root it out of the game, then you have to be severe in your punishment. It should be considered. It should be, you know, but it should be serious. I think players, it may be a serious fine as well, to hurt them in their pocket, would make it not worth their while and make them really reconsider their attitude. And that's what you have to do. You've got to change attitudes rather than slap people on the wrist.
Yeah, because the comparison has been drawn over the past couple of hours with Joey Barton and the QPR game at Man City last year. Okay, I think, was he punished somewhat for reputation as well in the 12 games he got?
Well, you know, yes, he's a blackguard, you know, and he has been for a long time. He's a fool, and he's you know, he probably got 12 games for that. But if he'd have been got early on, Damien, that's the point. You get these guys when they're young and you punish them severely, then they may well change their ways. And Joey Barton is probably a special case. But people who cheat or who commit violent acts on the field of play should you know, be punished severely. And that's the whole purpose of having any punishment, that it is a deterrent, that it stops people repeat offending, which is what you're trying to do. And Fellaini actually has got form, you know.
Yeah. Across Merseyside, not the best of weekends for Liverpool, beaten 3-1 at home by Aston Villa. And Villa, great value for that win.
They are, yeah. They're an interesting young side, Damien. I watched them in a few games recently, and they're all around 25 maybe or younger. Very young side. And have a very interesting forward, Belgian Benteke, centre-forward. Scored 2 goals on Saturday. He's a very potent young forward. Plays up there on his own. Strong, quick, an eye for goal. I think they have, you know, some very, very good young players. And he's been quite brave, Paul Lambert. He's done a really good job there. He's left Aaron Bent out, who's a, you know, expensive signing. He hasn't had Richard Dunn. He's left Jay Given out, for example. So he's doing a good job there quietly, because they're not far from the relegation places, or haven't been, but they're moving up the table now. And Liverpool, Pepe Reina was at fault for a couple of goals, badly at fault. He's having a really bad season, which is a big surprise. But in, you know, in the final analysis, Liverpool simply don't have the players. They've got one striker, Suarez. Steven Gerrard is coming, you know, I think to the end of his career now. He's been a very good player, but I don't see the quality there that Liverpool need to be where the fans expect them to be and where they have been traditionally. They just don't have the players.
But what struck me more from the weekend and to listen to Rodgers, and I think he's generally pretty honest in his assessment of games, but what I found very odd, okay, Sterling's only a young guy and adapting to Premier League football, but he spoke of fatigue across the squad, which is pretty frightening when you consider they've only played 17 games and the schedule hasn't been any more demanding than any other club.
No, and like Barcelona and Messi play, you know, twice a week sometimes, and they're playing many, many more games. I don't think fatigue should be a factor for Liverpool at all. I think it's mad talk. But if you start talking about it as a coach, you're only putting the idea into your players' minds in the first instance. You're giving them an excuse. I think Brendan Rodgers was outstanding at Swansea. If he had a squad of really good players, top four squad, he might get them into the top four, but he doesn't have the players. He might be the right man at the wrong moment, and I'm not sure if the money was all gone at Liverpool before he arrived on players he didn't want, noticeably Carroll, but also Henderson. So Enrique, who wasn't fit for Saturday. So, you know, all the money spent, high expectations, very young, callow team, not a good combination for longevity.
Speaking of longevity, Chelsea, this big long trip back from Japan, they weren't able to take off when they had hoped to because of restrictions, because of noise at the airport, so they only arrived back in today. Do you find the Club World Cup an unnecessary distraction?
I sure do, and I watched it as well, which is a penance.
Up out of bed early on Sunday morning?
No, it wasn't that early. It's half 10, but it was desperate stuff. The whole tournament is a joke. I mean, Manchester United jumped out of the FA Cup many years ago to go and play in it, but it's not serious. stuff, and Corinthians are no good team. It was a terrible match, really terrible. Chelsea had chances to win it, and Torres missed a couple of really good chances, but it was desperate stuff. And I don't know, there's no prestige in it. It's something that I think Sepp Blatter wants to do. He likes to travel, but I don't think... And Chelsea have a big match against Leeds in the semi-final, quarter-final, is it? Or the semi-final of the...
Quarterfinal.
It's called the Capital One Cup.
Yeah, the milk cup and all money.
Yeah, exactly.
But it seems to be a thing, and we spoke to Pat Nevin on the programme last week about it, that is it just an English thing that they don't take it as seriously as... I'm reading the Guillaume Balague's biography of Pep Guardiola, and he shed a tear when he won it at having led Barcelona to a competition the club had never won, and the South Americans seem to take it quite seriously as well.
Well, perhaps, yeah. I think it may be that the English don't take it as seriously as they should. I'm quite... A certain Rafa Benitez was taking it seriously because he needs every break he can get at the moment and every victory he can get. Chelsea really were the better team, actually. They should have won it, but they back four with Luiz in it is terrible. You know, without John Terry, Chelsea is simply not the same team. And I probably think winning the World Club Championship is not on anyone's list of priorities. Even Pep Guardiola, the Champions League is... And La Liga is where it's at. And in that context, Barcelona had a huge victory last night, Damien. They played Atletico Madrid at the Camp Nou. Went 1-0 down to a magnificent goal from Falcao, who's going to be a real superstar. Well, he is a real superstar. And then came back and won 3-1. And that was a hell of a game. It was a really magnificent football from both teams.
Yeah, and Madrid and Espanyol before, it wasn't too bad to watch either.
I watched it, and Madrid are in big trouble, you know.
Eamon, it's our last chat of the year, so for your time each of the Mondays, to you, to Jane and all the family, have a good Christmas.
Thank
and we'll,
much,
we'll chat in 2013.
And the same to you.
Thanks indeed. Eamon Dunphy joining us there. The Horseport Ireland Awards for 2012 took place at Croke Park today. It's helped supply a certain quiz question for the future. As guests congregated at the Hogan Stand, two fences could be seen on display on the Hill 16 end of the ground. So name the show jumper who made history by leading a horse over obstacles at the home of Gaelic Games. The answer, London Olympic bronze medalist Keane O'Connor.
Yeah, it's certainly very cool. I mean, to have been the first to come in here with a horse, it was a bit daunting because I wasn't sure if the horse was going to play ball, pardon the pun, in the ring, because one big single fence at 1.60 metres, the London bus, I wasn't sure if he was going to make strange, but he jumped it really well, and it's certainly nice to have done it. The chief executive of Horseport Ireland is a big GAA man, Damien MacDonald. He's involved with coaching hurling, actually, in Wexford, and I think he came up with the idea and he put it into place.
To look up at the scoreboard, Keane O'Connor, Olympic bronze medalist, London 2012, you won't get sick of hearing that.
No, it's certainly very nice, and I suppose when I look back on the last 8 years, you know, we all sometimes get knocks in life and you reach a certain low, but to have come back from there and to have the year that I've had this year culminating in the Olympic medal is extraordinary. But I suppose that's what, in the horse world anyway, that's what helps us get up and go every morning, is that hope of a chance encounter with a four-legged animal, whether it's the young horse around the corner or putting together a syndicate to find a superstar like Blue Lloyd. It's amazing how one horse can change your life.
But to go back to London, because on the morning that you won the medal, you weren't listed to compete. Do you believe in destiny, that it was meant to happen, that you were meant to get that opportunity?
Maybe there's somebody up above helping me or looking down on me, that's for sure. A lot of things went my way.
You'd planned for it the evening before, you were convinced you would get the chance to compete the following day.
That's right. Well, we put a lot of work into getting to London. I mean, there was plenty of hurdles to be jumped before we even got to the show jumping arena. You needed a bit of luck, and when I had the opportunity, I took it with both hands. I suppose a lot of people have helped, and as my late grandfather would say, success is reward for effort, and there's been a lot of effort on a lot of people to help me get there.
Does it change things? Do people interact with you differently?
Internationally, I've always, you know, garnered great respect, and amongst my peers and in my business, internationally, it certainly you know, has always been good. I suppose at home here, yeah, there's a little bit more openness towards me, which is nice. And I suppose you finally put to bed that, you know, I can hold my head high, and there's no other rider has been on the podium twice individually in show jumping in their life. So to finally have brought home Ireland's first equestrian medal in the bronze of London 2012 is something very special, I suppose, for equestrian sport as well.
We've had so much success across the board. It hasn't been replicated on Olympic level for whatever reason.
Yeah, I suppose the Olympics is is the ultimate. It's the final day, the greatest test of horse and rider, and things have to go your way, and it all worked out for us, thankfully, and now the plan is to work towards Rio in 2016. Blue Lloyd was sold actually last week, and the plan will be to source younger horses to be in a strong position to have perhaps a choice of two or three horses that I could take to try and help the Irish team win gold in Rio.
Kian O'Connor there. We heard mention of Horsesport Ireland Chief Executive Damien McDonald, his reflections on 2012 in a moment. But first, how did show jumping come to Croke Park?
No, Damien, I'm very grateful to the people in Croke Park, Peter McKenna in particular, and Alan Gallagher, who gave us permission to use the pitch today. It's a historic occasion, and they were worried about creating a precedent, but I said the next time we win a medal, we won't be back for 4 years anyway if we win another one in Rio de Janeiro, and I think they'd gladly give us a run again in 4 years if we can win another medal.
What a year it has been. I know you're here for your annual awards and your lunch. There's plenty of people watching on as Keane went round on the pitch. It's a phenomenal 2012 to reflect upon.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, we're the only sport in which we won a medal at the Olympics and Paralympics, 7 underage European medels. It's been really an unbelievable year, and winning the Aga Khan at Dublin as well, which is absolutely fantastic in front of the home crowd. So, look, it's amazing. I mean, the sport has had its ups and downs in recent years, more downs than ups, to be honest. So it's a dream come true to be celebrating a year like this. When we came back from the Olympics in 2008, we were in a dark place, and you know, so much has changed in 4 years. It's hard to credit.
Because I think we even spoke during London that what success we've had elsewhere hasn't been replicated on the Olympic level. Are you positive now looking forward to 2016? Are there plans in place, or is it far too early to be looking at Rio?
No, we were already making plans. Obviously, Rio is logistically more challenging because you have to fly the horses over and so on. I mean, it's an amazing statistic, really, that equestrian sport has been in the Olympics since 1912, and this is the first medal we have, given our tradition for horses. I mean, I think there's a guy writing the history of the Olympic Games now soon. He's trying to explain what happened every year since 1912. So, yeah, it's onwards and upwards from Rio. It looks a long way away, but it'll come around the corner very quickly. But in between that, Damien, there's a huge amount of big competitions on. I mean, the Aga Khan next year, it'd be great to win it again. You know, on the eventing side, we'd be badminton. So, you know, maybe the media doesn't pay that much attention to the sport in between the Olympics, but there are huge competitions going on in between each Olympic Games.
Damien McDonald speaking there at Croke Park earlier this afternoon, and Kian O'Connor ahead of him. Just a reminder, we'll give you one more chance to enter that competition. We have 10 copies of The History of Leinster Rugby to give away on DVD. I think it's over 4 hours reflecting on Leinster's past, so a good stocking filler for next week. Our question, we want you to tell us, who did Michael Checa replace as coach of Leinster Rugby? 5-1-5-5-1. We will finish the programme on a sad note, where we will be well aware at this stage that tributes continue to be paid to the late Paddy O'Shea, who passed away at his home in Ventry on Saturday morning at the age of 57. His football career saw him win a record equaling 8 senior All-Irelands with Kerry. He was the county's captain in 1985 and manager in 1997 and 2000. His life, though, encompassed far more than that, and that's been marked by the fact that people are travelling from every corner of the country, by some reports, to remember the man in Kerry over the course of today. Let's hear from Radio Kerry's Wishy Fogarty on the outpouring of emotion and the shock in the county at Paddy's passing.
Well, Damien, I have very rarely, if ever, have I seen Kerry so shocked and such an outpouring of grief as I have seen at the death of Paddy O'Shea. It's unique, really, and it's different. And I can tell you the one thing I've noticed about it, he probably has been the most loved Kerry footballer outside of the county than he has even been inside the county, because people from outside the county, as you were just after mentioning, there are people travelling from all over. And not alone that, on the other hand then, is in Kerry have produced some great football personalities down through the decades and down through the centuries. But I'm thinking and listening, since Paddy O'Shea's death, I think he would rank as probably one of the greatest GAA personalities, one of the greatest GAA workers that this county has ever produced.
You mentioned a key word there, personality. He was the type of character that transcended sport, and people who would not have an interest in Gaelic football, may not have an interest in Kerry football, knew who he was by virtue of the type of individual he was.
He was, Damien, because I'll tell you why. He transcended everything else. He was with us, in front of us, and he was shaping people's lives for over 40 years, would you believe? Because when he started playing Kerry Minor and playing with colleges away back in the early 70s, I remember the first time I ever saw him kicking a ball when he was training in his own, kicking the ball up in the air, running on and catching it, and kicking it up again and running on, and he'd keep at that. So from that time with the colleges right up until the present day, and when he finished his playing career, of course, he went into the managerial career and then went up to Westmeath, and then he was also involved in politics. So if you like, and look at it carefully, carefully, he was a national figure, Damien, not alone just through the GAA.
Do you think he was aware of how close to the hearts of people he was held?
I don't think he did, I'll tell you the truth. I don't think he did. I'd say he might have been disappointed that time when the Kerry job was taken from him. And he was kind of really, he was kind of eased out or forced out that time. And it was a bit, wasn't very nice that particular time. And then he went up to Westmeath and he showed the people really what a great manager he was. But I don't think he realised it really, because he was that type of a person. Away from the maddening crowds, Damien, he was a very courteous man, very kind, very giving of his time, and very giving of his time to the media, which is very important in the role that he was in and the role the media played in his life. And he was a very courteous person. And when you'd meet him on his own, and I have often at matches before games when Kerry'd be travelling and I'd be travelling, we'd meet him in the morning of a match, sit down, have a cup of coffee. He was one of those people, he'd always ask you how you were, how's your health? He'd ask you how your family were, and he'd ask you various things of your life. And when you're dealing with GAA personalities on most occasions, they really speak about themselves. But Paddy O'Shea didn't do that. He always looked to others, Damien.
And history will remember him as one of the best. He'll be so sadly missed, but so fondly remembered. Vuichy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Damien. You're very welcome.